Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the Soviet Union collapse so suddenly and so peacefully? While Western analysts spent decades pondering the conditions that might reunite Germany and bring the communist empire to its knees, few, if any, imagined it would happen almost bloodlessly before the close of the 1980s. Yet while 1989 began as a year of business as usual, the world entered 1990 with six former communist strongholds freed from Soviet control and eager to reinvent themselves as modern democracies. Writer Victor Sebastian covered much of it firsthand as a journalist. His new book on that miraculous year is called Revolution 1989, The Fall of the Soviet Empire. Victor, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much for asking me. It's a great pleasure to be here, to be with you.
We've heard enough, I guess you could call it revisionist analysis in the past 20 years, that it makes sense, I think, to start this discussion with the point that you make at the start of your book, which is that the collapse of the Soviet Union was not only not predictable, but it was not inevitable. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, not inevitable because, as most analysts thought, the Soviet Union could limp on for decades as a sort of upper volta with nukes, as it was called. Lots of countries continue being very, very poor. It could have been like the Ottoman Empire that died. It took about 300 years to die. There's nothing inevitable. It was all going to happen in a few short months, virtually no analyst that even had contemplated it. I interviewed James Baker, who the Texan Secretary of State at the time, and I interviewed him in doing this book. And he said to me, I wish I could do the Texas accent, but I won't try it. He said to me that if anyone tells you they saw it coming the way it did, they're blowing smoke at you. He was right.
Of course, everyone's familiar with the fact that communism was based on the ideas of Karl Marx, who dreamed of this egalitarian utopia of common ownership. But to what extent did communist leaders still believe in those values by the 1980s?
Very, very, very few believed in those by the 80s. There was an interview with the Bulgarian leader, a man called Todor Zhivkov, who had been in charge for about 25 years, and he was asked the end of 87 or the beginning of 88, presumably, you believe such and such is going to happen because this is what is predicted. And he said, "What, do you take me for a fool?" And this was a man who'd been proclaiming it and running this society for 25 years. So in most of these countries, Communist Party membership was about 10%. That was sort of average for most of them, and almost all of them were careerists. You needed to be a Communist Party member to get certain jobs in these countries. In fact, even to run a major sports team, you needed to be a Communist Party member. To be a head teacher at a major school, you had to be a Communist Party member. That was the system. People had cynicism had eaten into the heart of communism a long time before. By 1956, Hungarian invasion had done that. 1968, Prague. Most people ceased to believe. They paid lip service to it.
And if there was one thing people hated more than their own governments in Soviet bloc countries, it was their Soviet occupiers.
Absolutely. I mean, they were colonies, effectively, and all of them have been. It was entirely as a result of what happened at the end of the Second World War, and in many of these countries had a long history of hatred of Russia, and that was as big a factor. The nationalism was as big a factor as hatred of communism.
I think it's really interesting here. You remind us that initially after the Second World War, the economies of communist Europe were growing just about as quickly as those in Western Europe. At what point did that start to change?
that started to change in sort of late 60s, really, or early 60s, early to mid 60s. I mean, economists disagree, but this started in the war from a pretty low base of destruction, and the system in times of shortage and acute of difficulty, the communist system can work off, can work rather better than at a time of growth. The sort of irony that when you feel everyone's pulling together and needs to for the sake of us all, there is a kind of idealism in that ethic, and that system, you know, in extremis can work for a short while, but it won't last. And the moment they began to separate and the growth in the West advanced, it advanced at a pace totally outstripping the command system, and very, very quickly. And then, of course, it grows exponentially.
And then it became essentially unsustainable for these economies to be bolstered by their governments because there weren't these boom periods.
Well, I mean, foreign debt was it's a familiar problem now, but it was a terrible problem for these countries, because most of them were the only way they could stock shelves in their food stores was by borrowing money from the West. At the end of the 1980s, East Germany and Hungary were spending around 3/4 of their national income simply on servicing the debt on existing loans. They had to take out more loans just to pay off the interest. It's like a sort of madman with a platinum credit card.
And although they weren't speaking about this publicly, they were well aware of it behind closed doors and concerned about what they were going to do.
Only three people knew about it in East Germany. And the guy who actually took over just a month before the Berlin Wall fell, in charge of East Germany, didn't know quite the extent of the economic disaster he was inheriting. Almost nobody knew in some of the countries. In others, like Hungary and in Poland, which was slightly more open already, but by then, more people were aware of the system.
Well, part of the issue. Continue. Go ahead.
Sorry, it was Western bankers brought down communism as much as anyone else did.
Part of the issue here is that, as you alluded to earlier, advancement within the Communist Party had never been based as much on ability and dynamism as on party loyalty. So ultimately, the best and brightest were not the ones in charge when things started to fall apart.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was a miracle that it was an extraordinary event that someone with a real creative imagination and brains and ability like Gorbachev could rise in a system like the Soviet Union, and it defied all the logical odds. And a lot of the people around him were totally mediocre, and those who preceded him. It was a real exception to find people of real ability. The system knocked out anyone with imagination or independent thought.
Gorbachev, of course, was the last president of the Soviet Union, and you characterize him here as a man who did the right things for the wrong reasons. His intention initially was to save communism.
Absolutely, he was a lifelong communist. The party gave him everything, and he was a great, he was a true. He, when I said earlier that a lot of people had cynicism and eaten into the heart of communism. Not into Gorbachev's heart. He was a true believer still, even virtually right to the end. And he thought that losing the deadwood in the empire in Europe was, and concentrating on protecting communism in the Soviet Union was the best way to save the system that he still cared about, even in the late 80s.
How did the Chernobyl accident lay the groundwork for what would come 3 years later?
It was a very, very big factor because Gorbachev didn't. He was lied to himself about how it happened. He'd been told by his experts this could not possibly happen. He didn't know at that point quite the extent to which the military were spending and what control they had in the civilian nuclear program. It was a shock to him that a disaster like this could happen, like that could happen in the Soviet Union, and it changed him radically. He tried to take on the military. He tried to reduce spending on the military after that. He tried to reach more accommodations with the Americans after that to get quicker deals going. It was a profound shock to him that it could have happened in his beloved Soviet Union. He knew things didn't work, but he didn't think they were as bad as that.
Another significant turning point for the USSR was the long and ultimately futile occupation of Afghanistan. By the end of that period, leaders in the Kremlin had started to understand the limits of their on-the-ground military power to impose their will.
I'm sorry. Something creaky happened there. Could you repeat that question, Chris?
Sure. I was wondering if you could talk about the turning point for the USSR that came at the end of the Afghanistan occupation.
Well, the Afghanistan disaster was a real. That was one of the big contributing factor for the fall of their empire. But it went backwards. They realized much earlier that they were in a disaster, and trying to get out was a significant problem. It was one of the main reasons they gave the Afghanistan disaster for them was one of the main reasons why they didn't see themselves in a position to intervene anywhere else in their domains even before Gorbachev had taken over. It was a very, very significant, thing. In Gorbachev's time, then he decided to try and get out almost as soon as he took over in 1985, but found that it wasn't an easy matter pulling out because you lose face and you give your opponents. It's quite a hard thing to do to find peace with honor.
What made Gorbachev believe that letting this relatively small number of breakaway states go would keep the rest of the Soviet Union loyal?
Well, that's an extremely good question. He thought he could concentrate. What was happening was they were guaranteeing, again, some of this is financial, that the Soviet Union was guaranteeing the debts of a lot of these and the economies of a lot of these countries. If they could concentrate their financial resources just on the Soviet Union, if they could come to agreements with the West about reducing arms limitation, that would save them a great deal of money, and they could, which they could then spend on a whole lot of civilian projects and maintaining communism. They thought that might work. They were in a serious disaster themselves because of falling oil prices. Their oil prices, which Soviet Union depended, oil in, exports on which the Soviet Union depended, fell by from about $40 a barrel to $10 a barrel within about 2 or 3 years, and their income was, they were almost bankrupt by 1989.
Victor Sebastian is my guest. Let me have you take a break there. We need to take a quick break. The new book is called Revolution 1989, The Fall of the Soviet Empire. We'll return in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Victor Sebastian is with us. His new book is called Revolution 1989, The Fall of the Soviet Empire. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk for a minute, Victor, about another key player in the fall of communism, Pope John Paul II. Not only was he a native of Poland, but the Kremlin had in fact been aware of him for decades before he was made pope. What did they fear from his influence?
Well, they feared the power of his message. They actually felt that someone who really meant it, who would confront them, could be a real threat. The day he was elected, the head of the KGB rang. The day he was elected pope, rather, in 1978, the head of the KGB, Yuri Andropov, phoned up all the other members in the leadership and said, "This could be potentially a real disaster for us." I quote him more or less exactly, and he realized the extent to which a man of John Paul's towering, you know, they realized what a kind of extraordinary messianic type of figure he was, and they were threatened by him and realized straight away that this could be trouble for them. And his influence was enormous in this whole story, but mainly in Poland. It has to be said, obviously. Elsewhere in Eastern Europe, the Pope John Paul was a slightly less influential figure. It has to be said, but still a frightening one from the Kremlin's point of view.
And I guess the Catholic Church was uniquely powerful in Poland in a way that it wasn't in other Soviet bloc countries.
That's true, and it had come to deals with the communist regime in Poland that gave the church much more freedom in Poland than anywhere else in Eastern Europe. They had far more seminaries, far more bishops, far more priests than anywhere else. It had come to a series of negotiations, giving them some autonomy.
I was shocked to read that the KGB actually bugged the Vatican on a number of occasions.
It did, yeah. Or tried to, but didn't come up with anything much because they knew it was happening. It was routinely swept by counter espionage. The Pope's own security people knew that he was being bugged. He knew he was being bugged. He had been bugged as when he had been Archbishop of Krakow in Poland. So it wasn't, you know, he knew when he could be discreet and where he shouldn't be anyway. So I don't think they learned very much from it.
What kinds of deliberations took place within the Kremlin before John Paul was allowed to visit Poland?
Well, the Kremlin had tried to stop it. Their advice, they didn't stop it. The Poles were, even some of the diehard party leaders were quite proud that a Pole had been elected pope, even though they could sense that this was, you know, not going to be entirely easy for them. At that point, there was such expectation of the visit that if they tried to stop it, the regime would have been in serious trouble. But the Soviet leader at the time, Brezhnev, advised the Polish regime's leader, Eduard Jerzyk, at that time, don't let him come. It's up to you. It's your call, but don't let him come. Otherwise, there'll be trouble. But the Polish leader said, no, I'm in more trouble if I stop it. So he was wrong. In fact, I think it would probably, looking back, he might have thought it would have been made sense not to have allowed that very first visit.
Well, and of course, Poland already had this strong pro-labor movement under the leadership of Lech Walesa. Can you talk about the kinds of seeds that the Solidarity movement planted in the minds of the Polish people?
It was a little after that that Solidarity was born, but not by much. It was a hugely important factor because because the whole the basis of communism was that they were the representatives of the workers. This was a workers' state, and when you have genuine workers led by a genuine worker leader saying, "No, we are the workers," that was a real threat to the Soviet system in the way that a few dissident intellectuals writing Samizdat literature somewhere wasn't. And at one point they had 8 million, 9 million members. They had more members of Solidarity by far, more members of Solidarity than the Communist Party.
Victor Sebastian is my guest. His new book is called Revolution 1989, The Fall of the Soviet Empire. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Victor, what sort of influence did Western anti-communist sentiments have on the events of 1989?
Mixed. And there was the West, by its example, was an influence. But you could watch in places in East Germany, for example, even East Germany, which had a pretty near Stalinist regime, that people on the whole could watch West German television. But the biggest influence the West had was by the sheer its example, but it was different. And by the 80s, in most of these countries, not everywhere, but in a lot of these countries, not somewhere like Romania or Bulgaria, but certainly in most of them, they knew that the West was different. They knew the West was richer. They knew the West was more free. They knew that people could travel from, you know, in the West. They understood all this. So there's a matter of debate about how, you know, which Western leaders had more influence or not. But the biggest influence was just by its sheer example of being there.
Interestingly, for all her pro-democracy rhetoric, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher was terrified at the prospect of German reunification.
Well, she had very old-fashioned ideas about the Germans. So was François Mitterrand, France, terrified of German reunification, and Gorbachev didn't like the idea either very much. But they all realized. Thatcher was the most vitriolically against, but realized that she could wield her handbag as much as she liked, but actually she didn't have the power to stop it. So she stopped speaking against it after a while. But the irony was that for 40 years they were talking about how Germany should be, you know, reunited in a free market system. And the moment it was going to happen, they would have done their best to stop it. But the first President Bush, could see straight away that this was very likely to happen and was immediately for it.
What changed when Hungary announced that it would reopen its border with Austria?
Bigger in some ways than the celebration we just had earlier this week, although. It happened in May, and it was almost overlooked. That led to a huge number of people leaving East Germany and trying to get out through Hungary, driving through Czechoslovakia, through Hungary, and getting out, and hopefully getting out into West Germany through that way instead of going over the wall, under the wall, or through it, which was almost impossible. They found a way around it, and about 150,000 had done this, and that fueled this immense number of, you know, hemorrhaging people in East Germany, caused an immense panic. And psychologically, the fact that an Eastern country was relaxed about a border with the West had a profound impact everywhere throughout Eastern Europe. It terrified the people like Nicolae Ceausescu in Romania. Whereas Gorbachev was entirely relaxed about it. He said, "Oh, well, it's up to you." You know, when the Hungarian Prime Minister went to. He was incredibly nervous. This guy, Miklos Nemeth, I spoke to him about, you know, about this. He was incredibly nervous on the day he went to Moscow to say to them, you know, we're planning to, you know, do this, open this border. What have you got to say about it? And he said, well, you know, I wouldn't do it if I were you, but, you know, it's entirely up to you. This was, you know, for 40 years, the most of you, a great symbol of Soviet power. And Gorbachev just looked him in calmly in the eye and said, well, it's not my call. It's up to you.
What do you think Gorbachev expected from Glasnost and Perestroika?
Well, he expect from Glasnost, he opened up his hornet's nest. He knew, he pretty much knew that he couldn't put a stop to that once he'd started that process and was entirely relaxed about it. Perestroika was I say somewhere in it that actually it's a word that meant whatever he chose it to mean at any particular moment. There wasn't, it meant restructuring, but he didn't really restructure the economic system in the Soviet Union at all. He barely touched it. He did touch the political system and tried to democratize it. And he did democratize it a great deal, which caused a lot. What he expected was the man to some extent was an idealist. He expected a more open, more honest communist system on the basis that he had always believed that it should and would be. And he thought that it would still, he thought that it would work, he would function better. Towards the end, he thought, actually, well, probably what we're going to end up with is Sweden or some sort of social democracy. Towards the end, at the start of this process, that's not what he thought at all.
And forgive me, because I don't remember if it's something that you wrote yourself in the book or if you were quoting someone, but there's this idea that with communism, the more you try to reform it, the more it's likely to crumble, because it sort of lived on that really, those tightly constricted codes of behavior.
I quote someone, and at the moment I can't remember. It's a Russian, I think it's Volkonov, a Russian academic, and who worked in a Russian academy. I mean, you know, you the system, you don't restructure at the edges, tinker around the edges of a system as decrepit and as bad and that was as doomed as the Soviet system was. I mean, you have to start from the foundations again, and I don't think Gorbachev quite understood that. The other thing, I'm a great, great admirer, as anyone who reads this book would know, of Mikhail Gorbachev in so many ways, but he's a man of great, great contradictions, and he had big blind spots. And one big blind spot is that even his greatest admirers accepted that he didn't really know very much about economics, even Marxist economics. And there were things he didn't try to he never tried to liberalize prices. He never really tried to create any kind of free market with even within the command system the way the Chinese started their reform process, for example. He didn't do any of that. Didn't touch it. He didn't touch the economic system, really. His perestroika was never calculated. It was always two steps forward, one back. It was much more tactical than strategic. He didn't quite know where exactly he was going to get to.
You know, I think if we look at another revolution of 1989, the Chinese government effectively crushed the student democratic rebellions at Tiananmen Square in the summer of 89. Why do you think that success, although it was bloody and horrible, didn't in fact embolden the Soviets to take similar revenge on their own breakaway republics?
Well, Gorbachev's a big factor. I've just criticized Gorbachev in some ways. Now, I will say why Gorbachev is a very, very great man and an enormous historic figure is that he made a decision that very few imperialists are prepared to make, that it's not worth keeping this empire is not worth shedding blood for. And despite all the pressures that were upon him and the conservative people inside the Kremlin, he had made this decision that he wasn't going to send in troops. He absolutely stuck by it, and it was a brave decision in many ways, a right decision, and one that he will always be remembered for. It makes him a remarkable figure in history. I've given you his weak points, but his strength and his vision and his idealism and in many other ways, I think he's a remarkable figure. I'm in awe of some of his sometimes the courage that he showed when the generals were standing up to him saying, no, we can't do this, we can't do that, and he's saying, no, we're going to do it. A brave man.
So since Monday, of course, we've been talking about the fall of the wall on November 9th, 1989. You have an amazing account here of the fact that it happened on that date in part due to a simple misstatement by the East German national spokesman.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't supposed to happen like that in that one day. Condoleezza Rice, who at that point was a bright young aide working for the first President Bush, called it the most colossal administrative error in history. This quite minor official, it was the East German, East Berlin party boss, was giving a press conference, and the leadership had made the decision to try and change the rules about visa rules about people leaving Germany that were supposed to come into effect the next day, and it was supposed to be an orderly queue. Anyway, this guy, Gunter Schabowski, is his name. He hadn't really read these documents. He was shuffling them about in front of him, and he was asked, "Well, when does these rules come into effect? Does it?" And he said, well, as far as I know, now, immediately, straight away.
Let me have you pause right there and finish the story right after our break. Victor Sebastian is my guest. We're talking about his book, Revolution 1989, The Fall of the Soviet Empire. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can make your passion your career. Evening classes are now available in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Victor Sebastian. His new book is called Revolution 1989, The Fall of the Soviet Empire. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. So, Victor, you were telling us this story of this East German official who accidentally says that in fact, crossing will be permitted essentially immediately between East and West Germany.
So what they thought, what the leadership in East Germany thought, was that there'd just be an orderly queue trying to get a passport, you know, starting the next morning when the rules were supposed to come into effect. What they got within an hour were thousands of people at border crossing points all saying, you know, let us out, Schabowski, Schabowski, Schabowski said so. And at that point, thousands of people on the streets at some of the border points, they could not hem them in. They'd not seen anything like this since the wall went up in 27 years before. And one of them, at one of the main border crossing points, disobeyed orders and just told his men to lift up the gates and let people through. And then the rest, well, you know, it was history and one of the most fantastic street parties of all time.
You write about this as the first televised revolution in history. I suppose that immediacy of that message, incorrect as it was, getting out immediately, was part of what captured that energy and made it happen.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it fueled It took a momentum all on its own. I mean, a week after that, the Velvet Revolution. People could see in Czechoslovakia. They knew what was they knew what had seen what was happening. That led to the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia a week after that. The last of the dictators, Ceausescu, was toppled when he was seen at a mass rally after he was jeered to completely lose, look scared and couldn't say a word and froze. And at that point, he showed his weakness. Television actually did play quite a major part in this story. There's a lot spoken around now about, you know, the power of the internet or Twitter or whatever, but that was the new technology of that era, and it did play a significant part in the event.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Henry in East Dallas. Hi, Henry.
Hi there, Mr. Sebastian. Perhaps you just answered the question that I have, which is what event or string of events emboldened people to physically attack the wall to bring it down and know that they could do so with impunity?
Well, I mean, they could be, but they didn't. It could have all happened so differently. And when they first went out, people didn't know they were at that point. They weren't absolutely sure that there wasn't going to be shooting on the streets. Throughout the story of 89, in hindsight, everything, everyone can think like it's inevitable. But there's a whole series of moments throughout that whole year when it could have worked out differently. If Schabowski had not made that misstatement, and there had been an orderly queue, and this momentum for change hadn't happened, it could have been different. If there are a lot of ifs here, which makes writing history, you know, so interesting. There's nothing inevitable about this at all. It didn't look inevitable at the time. And when people went out on the streets in other places on marches, they weren't absolutely sure that there wasn't going to be a Chinese type reaction. It seemed unlikely, but it wasn't impossible. That had happened, you know, it had happened before in the Soviet Empire. So people will still be, it still took courage to do what they did.
An email from Michael asks, how long did the old East German government remain in power after the wall came down, and how did they manage an orderly power shift?
Well, basically, the orderly transition was that West Germany just simply took them over. How long did the new East German, the East German after the wall? A matter of weeks. Mm-hmm. And there was effectively the East German government ceased to exist that night, basically, in effect. The West Germany took over all their, you know, agreed to take over all their debts just a few days afterwards. I mean, they were tired. It took a few months to tie up loose ends, but effectively, the East German government ceased to exist that night.
Was there any tension socially in the newly unified Germany between the West Germans, who were somewhat advanced and considerably wealthier, taking in essentially people that one might even look at as refugees from this other country where they had experienced such deprivation for such a long
time? Oh, enormous, and there still is. Mm-hmm. There's to some extent, I mean, much less than there was then. But for a while in Germany, there certainly was. There was resentment. That night when thousands, and, you know, scores of thousands of people going from east to west, there were one or two going from west to east with wads of cash already buying things up. I mean, you could see them. It caused some tension for a long while that hasn't. It's still in the East Germany, eastern parts of the United Germany, the unemployment is something like 13%, and in the average parts of Western Germany, it's more like 6.5%. So there's still a lot. There's still a lot of tension there. There are Rust Belt areas which will probably never be redeveloped. It's been a pretty good success story, but not, you know, there have been some losers along with the winners.
Let's go next on the phones to Marshall in Dallas. Hello, Marshall.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hello?
Marshall.
Hello.
Okay, now I think we can hear you. Go ahead.
I'm calling about the Soviet dissident Andrei Amalric, who wrote a book that came out in 1970 called Will the Soviet Union Survive Until 1984? And he gave at least three reasons. One is a general disillusionment with the ideology. The second was the rise of the non-Russian minorities in terms of population against the great Russian minority, which basically ruled the empire. And the third one was the ever-increasing dysfunction of the Soviet bureaucracy to rule the country. His reasons seemed to be very prescient, but he also wrote another article for Harper's Magazine that came out about 1975, in which he talked about being followed by the KGB. And he went into a KGB office, demanded to speak to someone in charge. He asked them, why are they following him? And he only got back an apologetic, embarrassed reply. When I read that, I thought that a Soviet secret police that no longer truly believes in its mission, like under Beria, had a very deep rot. And maybe we were going to be free of communism one day. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
No, that's a very good, very helpful observation. There were one or two people who did foresee this, but they were very, very rare and real exceptions, and they were normally treated as though they were very eccentric. They weren't believed.
We should talk about the fact that you are the son of Hungarian parents who fled with you after the thwarted revolution of 1956, and then you witnessed the fall of communism firsthand as a journalist. Can you talk about the sort of how you managed what must have been an extraordinary level of excitement within yourself to the extent that you were able to cover these events objectively?
I was a baby when my family left Hungary. Literally, I was 6 months old, so I didn't really experience growing up I didn't experience that at all. And I started traveling back to Eastern Europe in the late 70s, early 80s as a journalist occasionally, and then much more often through the 80s. Obviously, the story to me wasn't just a story. It was more than a story. But this was something, you know, I was extraordinarily excited by. But in the end, you just got to, you know, like any journalist, you've just got to do your job. I think in a way, my experience gave me a better understanding of what living under communism was like, and perhaps a slightly different perspective than my colleagues, but it was a very exciting for all of them. None of us ever imagined. I don't know of a single reporter there at that time, as we were sitting there in the bars, who possibly could have thought, even 2 months before the Berlin Wall fell, that we will be seeing this. And you know, I didn't think I'd see it in my lifetime, even then.
So does that give you reason to hold out hope for places like Cuba and North Korea?
Those are very different places, and they're kind of outposts. I mean, Cuba, I think if American policy had been different about Cuba for the last 20, 30 years, it would have been, America had just tried to buy Cuba. We got rid of communism years ago there, but the blockade has just been has elongated the life of the communist system much more than its natural life would have been. North Korea is a different system, and I've never been there. I don't know enough about it. It gives me hope. If it's going to happen, I expect it'll probably happen overnight in the way that it's happened elsewhere. I don't know. Maybe their best, their repressive system is probably pretty efficient. But yes, I hold out hope, because these systems cannot function, you know, forever. 70 years in Russia was, you know, the longest whack. I don't think it's going to last that long anywhere else.
Can you talk briefly about the influence that the events of 1989 had on the world beyond the borders of the Soviet Union in terms of communism?
Well, not only I think 1989 was a beacon for other places, not just outside, you know, outside. The Soviet Union, it's collapsed after that, 2 years after, you know, after that. Then the nationalist movements inside the Soviet Union, the Baltic republics, Georgia, Ukraine, all went their own way. And when Gorbachev thought that it would actually leave him more control, what actually happened was that he ended up with much less control. But the influence of 89 spread in other, you know, in other places too, way beyond that region. It had an enormous effect in Africa. I mean, it was only 3 months after the Berlin Wall fell that Nelson Mandela was released in South Africa, for example. It had an enormous impact on freedom in other, you know, in other regions of the world too. So it held out a great beacon of hope for all of us at that time. There have been disappointments since then, but basically that I start the book saying this is a story with a happy ending, and I end it on the 31st of December. 1989, and I'll stick with that view that it's a story with a happy ending.
Yeah, I suppose it has been complicated as these countries have transitioned and some missed that stability. But it must be nice for you to have a story that once in a while gets to end on exactly the note that you'd like.
Well, they're bound to be, and especially now, the whole world is facing economic problems, and some of these countries are doing worse than others. Of course, they've been important. Real problems with transition. But there are statistics now that in East Germany, that 10% of the people think they were better off under the old system. I'm surprised in some ways the figure isn't bigger than that. There is a kind of nostalgia going on.
Victor, I'm so sorry that we're out of time. The new book is called Revolution 1989 by Victor Sebastian. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, thank you very much for asking me. I really enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.